Thank you, Warren. Is Keynes really dead? John Maynard Keynes died on April 21, 1946, a few days short of 36 years ago. As far as I know, this fact is generally acknowledged, although there are periodic rumors of a resurrection and ascension. The religious analogy is apt because Keynesian economics has become a secular religion, a set of views about the economy and economic policy that are deemed immune to the normal standards of evidence, a set of views that are used to rationalize a variety of sometimes conflicting political positions in much the same way that the contestants in most major wars pray to the same God. My brief remarks this afternoon make two points. Keynesian economics, like an AGM invalid, is one, alive, but two, not well. The aging analogy is also apt because the differences in economic perspective are less a matter of political positions than a difference between generations. First, Keynesian economics is alive. Most people who now have positions of authority, whether in government, business, media, or the academy, share a fundamentally Keynesian perspective on the economy, even when they may differ on specific policies. Keynes was never more correct than when he concluded that, quote, madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribble of a few years back, unquote. The rapid acceptance of Keynesianism by the generation that came to maturity during World War II, I suspect, was a direct result of the success or the perceived success of the state in the English-speaking countries during that war. And maybe for that same reason, Keynesianism came very late to Germany and to Japan. In the 1970s, Nixon, as well as Milton Friedman, correctly observed for their generation that, quote, we are all Keynesians now, unquote. Although the Keynesian perspective was introduced by the Democratic left, it has become a shared perspective across the political spectrum of most of the now dominant generation. This conclusion is best illustrated by the conventional controversy over the federal deficit. The left has often encouraged or tolerated deficits, arguing that deficits increase total real output. The right has usually opposed deficits, arguing that deficits increase inflation. The shared presumption of both groups is that deficits increase aggregate demand, a presumption that has little or no empirical basis. Both groups share this fundamentally Keynesian presumption and differ primarily, if unconsciously, on the slope of the aggregate supply function. Last fall, at a quiet professional meeting in Washington, I managed to offend both groups. Based on a large body of empirical work, I reported that there appears to be no significant effect of federal deficits on inflation, or, somewhat more to my surprise, of federal deficits on interest rates. The two groups who were most outraged were the older Brookings economists, who suggested that I resign from the profession, and several senior Republican senators who suggested that I resign from the administration. I found myself in the press the next few days being described variously as either an apologist for the administration and at the same time being very strongly criticized by my colleagues. There's no way out, I'm afraid. There are several important reasons to be concerned about the large prospective deficits. But there are also very important differences in the economic effects depending upon whether the deficits are reduced by spending restraint, by tax increases, or by reinflation, which a focus on the deficit per se does not address. The crudest Keynesian arguments are still used by many people, in some cases unconsciously. item. The chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, arguing against further federal spending cuts, claims, quote, maintaining spending furthermore by promoting economic growth would ultimately shrink the deficit. It takes particular gall for Keynesians to criticize a similar supply-side conjecture about reducing tax rates. A senior Republican senator has recently submitted a bill to provide substantial temporary assistance to the housing industry, accompanied by a detailed quantitative analysis purporting to demonstrate that the multiplier effects of this program would generate more revenue than the costs. Item. Several of my administration colleagues have suggested that the expected recovery will be substantially strengthened in July of this year by a reduction in withholding rates and by the Social Security benefit increase. In fact, the 1982 tax cut has been in effect since the first of this year, although the withholding rates will not be cut until July. Any effect of this cut on the real economy will operate through the incentive effect on factor inputs and allocation, not on the effects of increased cash flow to some groups on aggregate demand. The Social Security increase, of course, must be offset by additional borrowing and should have no effect on aggregate demand. Item. A wide range of groups, including prominently a number of international organizations, are urging the administration to pursue a tighter fiscal policy and a more stimulative monetary policy based on a presumption that a smaller deficit would offset the inflationary effects of higher money growth. Again, there are several important reasons to reduce the deficit, but there is no trade-off between fiscal and monetary policy in controlling inflation. It is important to remember that the Keynesian framework was developed to explain the problems of the 1930s and is strictly relevant only to conditions of excess savings and near-zero market interest rates. Why do people use this same framework in a period of inadequate savings and very high interest rates? The simple answer, I believe, is that the Keynesian framework has become so widely shared that people find it convenient to rationalize whatever their political position, whatever political position that serves their own interest in the terms of that framework. The rhetoric of the left has been more explicitly Keynesian. The rhetoric of the right has been more apologetically Keynesian. But both have distilled their frenzy from the same academic scribbler. Second, Keynesian economics is not well. In the long run, Keynes frequently remarked, we are all dead. This observation does not necessarily apply, however, to ideas that are shared across generations. The important and important attribute of Keynesian economics is that for the most part it is not shared across generations. In the long run, the Keynesian perspective will probably die with the generation that now shares this perspective. The simple fact is that there are very few young scholars, very few Keynesians in the generation that reached maturity, say, in the last 20 years. The rejection of Keynesian economics by this generation, I suspect, may be due in part to the perception that the state did not perform particularly well during this period. Most younger economists recognize that Keynes's general theory was, at best, a special theory of conditions specific to the 1930s. Most economic theory is now based on the neoclassical foundations established by Keynes's great predecessors at Cambridge. And probably the most interesting challenge to this perspective is from the Austrian tradition. My own experience suggests that this new perspective, which is also an older perspective, is also more widely shared among younger people in government, in business, and the media. an ironic sense, the 1980 election represented a passing of the baton of governmental authority from the Keynesian generation to the younger generation. Although Reagan is the oldest man elected in the presidency and is from the same generation that dominated American government during the last 20 years, the generation that came to maturity during World War II, he is the first president since Eisenhower not captured by the Keynesian perspective. In contrast to Eisenhower, however, Reagan's economic orientation is closer to that of the younger generation. He is probably the first president with what I regard as fundamentally Jeffersonian political values and a neoclassical economic perspective. The most important recent evidence of the passing of the Keynesian era may be the rhetoric of the debate on this grand budget compromise that is supposedly underway. The conventional right and the conventional left have united on the importance of increasing taxes to supposedly reduce the deficit. The case for this position, however, is not being made in terms of the Keynesian argument to restrain aggregate demand, but in terms of what Keynes himself used to disparage as the Treasury view, or what is now better described as the Wall Street view, of to reducing the deficits in order to restore the capital markets. Again, the reasons why the left and the right have united on the importance of a tax increase are different, but their rationale is common, different from Keynesian economics, and maybe even better. Maybe I'm an incurable optimist. My sense, however, is that the Keynesian perspective, like the residue of a bad meal, will soon pass. A concluding comment. What difference does it make, except in the rhetoric of political debate, that one paradigm about how the economy works replaces another? What is the merit of Keynes' final comment on the general theory that, quote, sooner or late, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good or evil, unquote? As an idea monger myself, I am tempted by the thought that ideas are more important than merely in shaping the rhetoric or the rationale for whatever policies serve one's interests. As a social scientist, however, I am much less sure. Does it make a difference whether government spending is rationalized by Keynesian multipliers or by Pigouvian externalities? Does it make a difference whether a progressive income tax is rationalized as an automatic stabilizer or as an optimal Lindahl tax? Maybe so, maybe not. After the first 15 months of the Reagan administration, however, the change in rhetoric, at least to date, has been more significant than the change in policies. In fact, the federal spending share of our national output increased in 1981 and will continue to increase in 1982. The tax share of our national output increased in 1981, and who knows what will happen in the future. And the total number of federal regulations continues to increase. In any case, Keynes posed too sharp a distinction between ideas and vested interests. Ideas are among the several types of vested interests that people will defend at some cost. For that reason, it is important to sort out those ideas that may lead to good or evil, and to create vested interests in those ideas that are dangerous for the good. Thank you very much.